You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. We're taking a break over the next few weeks, so we're going to play you some of our favourite stories over the summertime. We'll be back with brand new episodes in February. This week, I get to choose a story, so I've chosen this story produced by Conchetta Caristo. I like this story because Conchetta is very funny, for one, but also because it makes me feel better about being someone who routinely overshares every little detail in my life, even the ones that people maybe don't want to hear. I hope you like it too. A content warning, this story contains swears.
The people who know me know that I'm an open book. I am super fucking vulnerable all of the time and want to talk about everything. But I used to be a closed book. Until one night, I couldn't keep that book shut anymore. It was pried open through the power of diarrhea. I was at a house party for a friend's birthday. I was in a new relationship at the time with a lovely, sweet man called Aiden. I was quite tipsy and enjoying myself, having a conversation with him and a close friend of mine. We were all chatting and laughing. Then at one point, something clicked in my brain and I started to think that the two of them were really hitting it off without me. I was like, oh my God, duh, they're in love. Of course he wants this beautiful shiny-haired fox and not you, right? It was like game over for me. My crushed little heart was like parachuting out of my body. Now I know you're probably thinking, yikes, chill, are you all good, dude? And no, dude, clearly I was not all good. Something you should know about me is that I'm hypersensitive to rejection. Like, I'm always looking out for it, ready at any second for someone to hurt me. And so when I do feel rejected, my brain sort of shuts off and goes into a fight or flight mode, and I just react. So I reacted by drinking a lot. I think the formal scientific term is binge drinking. When I kept dodging various interactions with Aiden throughout the night, he eventually pulled me aside to ask me what was going on and find out what was upsetting me. But instead of trying to explain the complex cocktail of hurt and shame I was feeling, I chose to push it all down. Classic. You know how they say humans are like 98% water? I'm like that, but 98% emotions. My whole being is propelled by my feelings. Rational thoughts barely get a word in. So in the heat of the moment, my fight response won, and I called an Uber. As Aiden was begging me to just communicate with him, I flew into the car and slammed the door, staring at him with tears in my eyes as the car pulled away. It was super dramatic. So as I was sitting in this Uber, I started to feel really queasy. I had to ask him to pull over. I swear to you, I fell out of that car so fast and fell into the gutter and just vomited my soul out. It came in waves. I'd catch my breath and then it would come back again. The Uber waited there for ages. I had no idea what he was doing, but I wanted more than anything to tell him to leave so he didn't have to waste his time and so I could vomit in peace. Eventually, the Uber driver gets out and walks over to me, and with all the energy I could muster, I'm like, leave! And so he threw my bag out of the car and drove off. Then my good friend calls me from a festival, high and looking for a chat, but is met with my psycho screaming and crying as I try to explain what's just happened to me. He tells me, don't worry, I'll call your mom, and hangs up. So as I lay strewn across the grass behind the gutter, which I realize I haven't mentioned before where I am, so for the integrity of the story and for anybody who's familiar, it's at the bottom of Norton Street in Leichhardt, opposite a beautiful Italian restaurant called Grappa, which I've been to before and really do recommend. I hear a car pull up next to me. It's mom. Oh my God, what have you done? I was so relieved. I started crying and I kept asking her if she still loved me. In her disappointment and frustration, she urged me to get into the car so she could take me home. But I was too sick to move, so she just has to watch as my poor, limp body convulsed each time I coughed up this awful, deep bile into the grass. After a little while, just as I was slowly getting prepared to make the move to the car, I felt a sudden pang in my stomach. Something was coming, and it was coming fast. Mom. It dawned on her what was about to happen. Don't you fucking dare! But it was too late. The train had already left the station. I shuffled my way down into the gutter, pulled my panties aside, and began to shit. I shot liquid diarrhea out of my ass into a gutter on Norton Street at 2 a.m. in front of the proud woman who birthed me and raised me to do better. So the next day, I spent recovering. I got my punishment and paid my dues. When I finally had the energy to shower the shame off and move again, I remember asking my mum if I could tell Aiden or even anyone about what I'd done. Mum was adamant that I could never tell a soul about what had happened, especially not Aiden. But the more I thought I was supposed to hide it, the more I wanted to challenge that notion. What's the worst that could happen? How could I just live my life pretending that never happened? How could I possibly look someone in the eyes as they ask me, "Hey dude, like how are things with you?" and be like, "Oh yeah man, like things are good, not much to report here," when actually it should be less than 24 hours ago I shat in the street. That is what is up with me. I realized that I didn't want to go my whole life keeping a secret like that. I didn't want to be ashamed. So I decided to tell Aiden. And guess what? He proposed. No, of course he didn't propose. We did break up, but it wasn't because I shit myself. And that's a beautiful thing.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. All the Best is about training emerging Australian storytellers in the art of audio. If you'd like to be a part of the show, you can start by pitching to us at allthebestradio.com. We'll pair you with one of our supervising producers to help make your story.
Hey, my name is Chloe Gillespie and I'm one of the community coordinators at All the Best, and I'll be programming the next two stories for you to listen to. I've chose two stories with very differing emotions. The first is sad and the second is happy. So don't worry, there's light at the end of the tunnel. And that is coincidentally the name of the first story, the sad one, sorry. It's Light at the End of the Tunnel by Karishma Tanvi. And it is a story that actually made me cry in the car the first time I listened to it. It's about something very personal to Karishma, and it's just a really beautiful personal story to listen to. And I know I've repeated myself, but I don't want to spoil it or anything, so just listen to it, please.
I'm sitting on the bus on my way to work. I'm half-heartedly scrolling through my Facebook feed when I come across an article. I sit up straight. I'm wide awake as I read the title. Like many other women, I find sex agonizing. Ever since I was a teenager, I had a feeling that something wasn't right down there. In high school, my friends passed around tampons, but I made sure my pads were hidden deep inside my bag. I remember when I was 19 and sitting with friends in a car. I mentioned that I only use pads. They were shocked and kind of grossed out. I felt so embarrassed. I had tried using tampons before. I even went through a whole box trying to insert one, but it didn't work, not even a little bit. I thought to myself, how the hell am I gonna have sex if I can't even use a tampon? That first time came a few years later. I was prepared for it to be uncomfortable, but the pain was so awful, we had to stop because of it. First times though, right? Things would get better. But the pain is always there, flashing its face at my most intimate moments. Let me try and describe it. It's like a burning sensation, but not like a fiery or stinging burn. It feels like when someone is pulling and twisting at your skin, kind of like carpet burn. I have no idea why it feels like this. In the moment, I try to relax, I have a few beers, I think about how much I want this, but nothing seems to stop the pain down there. In my teen years, when all my friends were fooling around with boys, I was still trying to insert a stupid tampon. Then in our 20s, when they all started settling down with their partners, I just started dating. The pain made me feel so out of step with everyone else. I was deeply insecure about my body. Not so much how it looked, but how it was a bit broken. So I turned to Google to find answers. I racked my brain for suitable search engine words. Pain, sex, vagina, or vulva, burning, outside, maybe inside, no blood. The search results are overwhelming. I don't have an STI, I haven't had a baby. I don't think I'm allergic to latex. Nothing clicks. 6 months later, I visit the doctor with a fever. He asks about my medical history. He touches my back while he listens to my heart. He presses my ribs when he asks me to cough. He feels my forehead to check my temperature. He asks more questions and diagnoses me with the flu. While he makes notes on my file, I remember I don't come to the doctors often. All right, I'm just gonna do it. I'm gonna tell him about this other invisible illness I have. I push my nerves aside and I blurt out, "I find sex painful." He looks uncomfortable and avoids eye contact. He asks if there's any bleeding or discharge. I say no. He responds with, "You should just have more sex and the pain will go away." Is this seriously his medical opinion? Dude, sex is the problem. He didn't even ask me any questions and there was no physical examination like for my flu. I feel really disheartened. Some time passes and I find myself back at the doctor's to renew my contraception pill. This time I specifically request a female doctor. I tell her that I've been having sex for a year now and the burning pain isn't improving. I'm relieved when she starts asking me questions.
Yes.
Where does it hurt? What kind of pain is it? When does it happen? She prescribes me 6 months worth of thrush medication. I'm so confused. I've had thrush and I definitely don't have it now. She assures me that it'll reduce the skin sensitivities causing the pain. I'm not really convinced, but she is a doctor. So I bought the expensive medication, and 6 months later, nothing changed. I stopped dating. I know sex isn't everything, but I didn't have the energy to keep explaining to my partners what was going on. I couldn't even make sense of it myself. I tried. I really tried for years.
Have a glass of wine and relax.
Maybe you haven't met the right person yet.
Have you tried using lube? Only the water-based stuff.
Just have more sex.
Just have more sex.
Just have more sex.
This thing had consumed my thoughts for too long and was filling me up with anxiety. So I put it aside. No more dates, doctor's appointments, or asking friends for advice. It's relaxing not to think about it. Whatever, I'm healthy and safe. Things could be much worse. Everyone has a short straw in life, and this is the one I have drawn. I'm sitting on the bus on my way to work. I'm half-heartedly scrolling through my Facebook feed when I come across an article. Oh my God, this is me. The tearing pain, the transactional sex, the insecurity. This is totally me.
I'm Olivia Fennell, and I'm the author of the Guardian article, "Like Many Other Women, I Find Sex Agonizing."
Olivia was like me. Years of searching for answers, visits to the gynecologist, long nights on Google.
It's funny what search words come up when you're just desperately looking for something like pain, sex, vagina, penetration, like pulling, burning. I definitely tried to ignore it. I figured like I'd meet the right person and then I'd deal with it. But in my personal experience, nobody was understanding. I sort of thought I was a prude. That's what I thought it was. I was a prude and I was too frigid, which is something that boys like to toss around, I think, that girls are too frigid. So I didn't realize it was an actual condition.
Olivia tells me her condition is called vaginismus, where the muscles involuntarily contract and make penetration very painful. For the first time, I don't feel like it's all in my head. I don't feel alone.
The best thing to do is like just go and get treatment as soon as you can. Tell your partner as soon as you can. Don't drag it out for almost 10 years, which is what I did.
I find myself at the doctor's again, this time for my pap smear. For the occasion, I send out a village announcement to all my girlfriends to recommend me a doctor who specializes in sexual health. I don't care if I have to travel or if they don't bug Belle. For most people, this would be a routine procedure, but for me, it's a precipice. I don't know if it would work or what the doctor would say. My only comfort is Olivia's article bookmarked in my phone.
It gives you something to hold on to. It's like, okay, I'm not alone. This is a legitimate thing. It's a scientifically proven condition.
At this point, I've already diagnosed myself with vaginismus, but I want the doctor to reaffirm my opinion. I tell her about my painful sex and caution her the pap smear might not work. I'm already tearing up when I tell her. She opens a drawer full of speculums and reaches for the smallest one to put inside me. It takes some time, but it works. After I put my clothes back on, she tells me, unprompted, that I have vaginismus. Finally, after all these years, an answer that feels right. Okay, treatment should be straightforward, right? Probably a pill or some minor surgery. I reckon I'll be on my way to pain-free sex within weeks. But that's not the case. You start with months of pelvic floor physiotherapy.
She'd like put her gloves on, lube up her fingers.
You lie on a massage table face down while she pushes and prods,
releasing the tight muscles basically.
Over my underwear, massaging the innermost part of my thigh.
Kind of like in a circular motion, sort of.
And puts pressure on muscles I didn't even know existed.
She'd encourage me to do some stretches as well.
She tells me I am ready to move on to dilators. Wait, what?
The dilator wasn't fun. I had to basically, I was living with my parents at the time who were very conservative, very strict. So I had to do my dilator exercises late at night when everyone was in bed. And basically with the dilators, you get, they start off smaller, like those little Russian dolls, and they get incrementally bigger over time. So I'd, you know, like go into bed at night time, wait for everyone to go to bed. Then I'd put the lube on the dilator and like you literally just put it inside of you and you just kind of leave it there, and it's to allow the muscles to stretch and you can move it around and stuff. But I found that the hardest.
Today is my fourth physiotherapy session. I tell my physiotherapist that I did my exercises. I can now insert a super tampon. Yay me. I'm lying face down and she starts massaging my
transverse perineal,
which is the technical word for what my physio calls vajayjay strings. All the while we chat about work and what we did on the weekend. She uses code words for different medical parts and puts me at ease. It's a few months into treatment and she tells me I've improved. I get a gold star. I put my skirt back on. Everything feels so much more relaxed down there. There's no more tension. Like the muscles are just existing and not active. The improvements are happening slowly. There's still a long way to go, but I reckon there's light at the end of the tunnel.
I can say it definitely is treatable, and the other things that come with it, like the insecurity about your body, definitely you can easily overcome that. And I did overcome that more so than the actual pain. I overcame how I felt about myself. Yeah, you will get through it and you will overcome it for sure. It just will take some time, that's all.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. Over the summer, we're taking a break, so we've picked some of our favourite stories to play for you over the next few weeks.
As promised, the second story I've got for you is much happier, much sillier, and really fun. It's called Independent Browsing Time, and it's by Matilda Fay. I love this story because it's just such a dumb, silly idea. Matilda basically explains how she spends a lot of time with one of her best friends on her phone, both on their phones the whole time they're together, and they basically realize that hours can go past and they've hardly spoken. And I just think this is really interesting because I hang out with my friends a lot and we're all just on our phones, and sometimes they think it's bad, sometimes they don't care. And I just like how Matilda vehemently believes that it is a good use of time and a nice way to interact with friends in 2019. So yeah, give it a listen.
Do you ever do that thing where you sit there with someone else, flicking through your phone or playing around on your laptop, not saying a word to each other, And sometimes hours pass with you both there in your own little internet worlds. I think it's actually a pretty common activity that people do together. But my friend and I actually actively plan on doing this. And we've come up with a name for it.
You'd be like, WYD, do you want an IBT? And then if we both decide that we want an IBT, then you usually come over at some point with your lappy and we IBT. IBT is an acronym for Independent Browse Time. It basically means that we get together and independently browse on our separate browsing devices. And I think the very important adjective here is independent. So it's important that it's a private experience, even though it's a social one. Like, you can't ask the other person constantly what they're doing, or you can't try to have a full-on IRL conversation. You have to respect the integrity of IBT, and you have to have your own browsing experience separately but together.
So, for instance, someone couldn't show up to IBT without a phone or a laptop and expect to IBT with you?
No, obviously not. What a joke. God, that makes me uncomfortable just thinking about it. So you definitely can't sit there and like look over the other person's shoulder and see what they're browsing. That's against the rules.
Browsing is a pretty defining feature of this friendship. Sometimes it's planned and organised. We'll actually meet up in order to browse. But it started to creep into other times. As in, like, all the time.
So I think you and I were hanging out with my housemate, Mickey, for a while. And then Mickey left my room. And as soon as he left, the room just went silent. And both of us just whipped out our phones and started browsing. And then I think it was me. I think I stopped and I was like, wow. Like, I just realized that that was like the first time that we've had that much of a conversation in a long time. And as soon as the third party leaves, it's like we resort back to our natural state together, which is browsing. And then we talked about it for a bit, and you speculated that the only time that we actually really converse is when it's either completely socially unacceptable to browse, like when we're with other people, or when it's physically difficult for us to browse, as in like when we're walking. So we spend a lot of time together, but most of it's in silence.
Which is really nice.
Yeah, it is really nice.
Okay, so we've all heard the snide remarks directed at the young people in the cafe who are both just looking at their phones and barely talking to each other. And I've just realised we are those young people. And I'm so okay with it. That silent time together is really special.
So I can imagine to an onlooker it would look like we don't want to talk to each other. But I don't know, I find that the digital world is so like all-encompassing that to connect with someone on the internet, I feel like it's just as valid as connecting with them IRL. I mean, I see it as a pastime and a little bit of a vice. It is quite indulgent. We are just sitting there like it's a completely sedentary activity. We sit on the couch for like 5 hours. And like, to be honest, most of the time what I'm looking at and reading isn't really stimulating me in any intelligent way. It's just like dumb memes and like my Twitter feed, or like, I don't know, people having beef on Threads and like comments on Jamie Oliver recipes that I'm like screenshotting and sending you. I think the fact that we do it as an active like social occasion, that it's actually an excuse for us to get together, and it's an experience that we're sharing, I feel like it only brings us closer together. She is my best friend. Certainly not your average girl. Yeah, she's my best friend. She understands me when I'm feeling down.
sure hurts to be that way. Down, 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 down. You know it sure hurts to know that you're that kind of fella. Oh, here's to Mulberry Jane.
Here's to Mulberry Jane.
She met Jim when she came. Somebody cut off her feet. Now Jilly rolls in the street. If you want to see me,
All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Ryan Pemberton. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Lee Robinson. Matilda Fay is our social media producer, and I'm your host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and we're made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. You can find all of our episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so subscribe. We'll be back with new episodes in February.